From the editors at Paranormal Underground and Ghost Night Publishing, welcome to Paranormal Underground Presents, where you can explore the unexplained with our panel and special guests.
Welcome. We have an interesting show tonight. We're doing something different than we usually do. We're doing just a round table. What we've discovered is, as we've been talking with our guests, there's a lot of things that we would like to continue talking about. So that's what we're going to do today. Before we do that, let's go ahead and introduce who's with us. We have a few more people than usual. Our first panelist is Teresa West. Hey, Teresa.
Hi, Karen. How are you this evening?
Good. So you have some opinions on some of the things we're going to be talking about, right?
A few, yeah.
Our next panelist is our publisher. It's Chad Wilson. Hey, Chad.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. And then next we have sitting on our panel tonight, Shannon Sylvia. Hey, Shannon.
Evening.
Our science editor, J.D. Harrison. Hey, J.D.
Hey, Karen. How you doing?
Good. I want to talk to you a little bit about some Dybbuk box stuff.
I thought you would.
Yeah, well, you've been trying to tell me, and I keep saying, save it. So finally, it's time. Okay, and the last person sitting on our panel, it's our editor-in-chief, Cheryl Knight. Hey, Cheryl.
Hi, Karen. Thanks.
Let's go ahead and get started. The first thing that I wanted to talk about was something that we actually talked about with Shannon the last time she was with us, and she brought it up. Shannon, I understand that you're working on some stuff with legislation for background checks for paranormal investigators, and I kind of wanted to discuss that with the panel a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I am. I actually was supposed to meet with my senator on the 1st of May, and I had to reschedule for the 5th of June. This was prompted by sending a letter to the senator detailing the problems in the paranormal community and why it would affect a lot of the general public, especially when it comes to opening their homes to complete strangers. And she did write back to me personally and said, I want to discuss these issues with you. I'm concerned as well, and let's set up a meeting. So I've got my foot in the door. Very happy about that, which is huge because a lot of people didn't have faith that this would go any further than that. Yeah, this is the Massachusetts Senator Jennifer Flanagan. She became senator last fall. She's been in politics for 15 years, and she's wonderful. She's done a lot for our state and our town. And I think that there are a lot of topics I do need to cover with her, and if at least one of them actually passes some kind of law out of the 4 to 5 things that are really bothering me, I'll be happy.
One of the things we started to talk about a little bit, and then I think we had technical difficulty on podcasts that we did, was how that would go down. If there were background checks for paranormal investigators, how do you see that happening?
I think it would probably be easier for the public to possibly log into a website on the state's website, log in or do a search for people's background checks. So that's what I have to talk to Jennifer about, exactly how we would go about doing that. The thing I wanted to talk to her mostly about is, especially when it comes to events, events registering with the state. For instance, Salem, Massachusetts, which is the state I live in, every psychic medium or tarot card reader is required to get a license with the town of Salem, Massachusetts, and they're all required to register their events. So anytime they do an opportunity in town or a festival, they have to be registered. They have to document all of their information in with the town, and this is what I'm trying to achieve. For instance, TAPSCon fiasco. Money, tens of thousands of dollars, from what I hear, is still not refunded back to people, and it's easy for someone to just set up camp, you know, rake in all the cash, then take off and not do refunds. And what do you do about it? You can't call the Better Business Bureau. So I'm trying to, there's a bunch of things on my agenda that I want to talk to the senator about, and then I'm going to go about talking to other professionals and seeing exactly how we can get people to research background checks on investigators, or perhaps have Massachusetts investigators get licensed and then do a search on the website, or the state would require them to do a background check before they can get licensed. I don't know. I mean, that's a pipe dream, but I can at least say I'm trying.
Sure. Sure. Now, Chad, I know you had some opinions about this. You want to go ahead and share what you were thinking about that?
Well, I know my group in Tennessee, ETPRS, East Tennessee Paranormal Research Society, has actually been doing background checks since November of last year. And they did that basically because their lawyer said it would probably be a good idea, because I think he probably foresaw that being something that people would eventually have to do.
Nice.
So it's actually, there's groups out there that are doing it. It's just, I guess it's right now it's dependent on each individual group.
I did notice that there was something that happened, and I think I just blogged about this today, as a matter of fact. Well, I think I did. I just blogged about this today, is that something happened recently. There was actually a registered sex offender who was on a paranormal team. somebody brought it to light, and I don't want to get real specific in naming names, but some of the things that I wonder about, there's a lot of things that you then have to think about in conjunction with doing background checks. Who pays for it? How is it done? That type of thing.
I was thinking about that also. Shannon, that's a really good idea. You mentioned something about licensing, and that's what I'm wondering. What Karen just mentioned, you'd think that the individual who would be interested enough to be part of a paranormal group would pay for that background check themselves. But is that going to require groups to be licensed or individuals to be licensed to conduct a paranormal investigation? And if it did, how would you go about establishing licensure?
I think it's not going to happen, to tell you the truth. I don't think the state's going to care if licensed paranormal investigators are running around their state. I think it's mostly a thing that any of the hundreds of thousands of groups across the country should start enforcing. Patrick Byrne just talked about it, how he runs background checks. If anybody has a problem with theft, they're absolutely not on the team. I was just sent a background check on an investigator that I used to do a lot of appearances with, and found out that the guy just spent 8 years in prison for felony theft, aggravated assault with illegal use of weapons, also many stalking charges. So I had no idea until somebody had sent me that information, and sort of, you know, tucking my tail between the legs on this one. But, you know, it just recently happened a week ago. We were informed of this information, and would have been great to know a long time ago. This person's still doing events with people and going into people's homes and pitching his group on news stations. It's a shame. I'm just trying to initialize something. And that's what I want to pick my senator's brain about, because she's open to the idea. She's already seen my outline, and I want to ask her. That's where her expertise comes in. I want to say to her, what do you think we need to do to get, you know, people more background checks before they start entering people's homes, possible licensing and registering of events, you know, just some kind of paper trail for these people coming and going, not just the state, but the whole country, a paper trail when they're throwing these paranormal conferences. You don't know how many I've seen come and go that never happened, and they took people's money.
Yeah.
So anything.
I agree. That's great. I think that something like that should be in place. I mean, I know personally, speaking just for me, if I let a group of people in my house, I'm going to want to know something about them. I mean, I'm not just going to leave and let them have my home to roam about where, you know, do whatever they want to do. I mean, come on. That's just common sense. But
yeah.
I agree with that. There's nothing in place now, and there probably should be.
Absolutely, but the homeowner, I think, needs to take some personal responsibility as far as knowing who comes in your home. Now, of course, you're trusting that this group that you've contacted has fully vetted their people, I'm sure. But at the same time, I think that you have some responsibility as a parent, as a homeowner, whatever, about who's coming into your home as well.
Absolutely. Right. I'm with you on that. I wonder, though, if you start in the state of Massachusetts, can you get that uniform balance across the country? Because if there's no uniformity in the background checks and the licensure, then it could vary from state to state, and it would just be a joke.
Massachusetts is a very conservative state. We have more laws than anybody, I think. So that's why I have faith that my senator will help me pass something, you know, with the reps, something, because there are so many laws here. And then once a law is adapted, for instance, the Amber Alert in one state, you know, most of the states are adapting to that law. It'll pass on, and perhaps maybe through private organizations, maybe we can print some literature on homeowners, you know, do some advertising. Who knows? I mean, the possibilities are endless as to where this might happen if she does give me the go-ahead and say, yeah, there might be a concern here in the community. I mean, the paranormal field is huge right now. I mean, all the millions of viewers on television soaking up every paranormal television show. There's definitely an audience and a need for strict paranormal laws, because right now there's absolutely nothing, and that's the point I have to stress to her. There are no paranormal laws right now, nothing. You know, we got people sending out certifications for paranormal ghost hunting classes. Well, who's to say that they're certified? They're certifiable. It's baloney, and people are making thousands and thousands of dollars off of this. Tax-free, by the way.
And that's one of the things that I will tell you, because I have a lot of contact, and I look at a lot of paranormal groups and look on their websites and things, and the first thing that always raises a red flag for me are the paranormal groups who actually charge for what they do. Now, I'm not denying that people have a right to make a living, but at the same time, most of the paranormal groups that I see that seem fairly legitimate aren't going in there and charging you to go in and investigate your house. They might be doing other things to make mm-hmm. money, but not for the investigation itself. So,
yep.
Yeah.
It did recently become a hot topic because of the blogs on MySpace and like scifake.com, those kind of sites. We definitely need some legislation in place. I'm really glad to hear about the work you're doing, Shannon, around that. And I think that homeowners do need to take some personal responsibility, but I'm just surprised that it's not required by all groups, frankly.
Yeah, to go volunteer in your kid's school, you need to pass a background check.
Right.
That's right. You know, that's right.
So to be a teen mom, you have to be fingerprinted and you have to be background checked. I mean,
it's anything like, working with kids. Anything,
yeah, exactly. So
One thing I've discovered, being a ghost hunter myself, and I have a lot of exposure, so I have a lot of contact with people, paranormal groups that are up and coming are so excited about getting new members and getting a team going so they can start claiming and doing their first investigations. They don't care. I got to say, probably 99% of groups out there have never run a background check on someone, or they recruit their friends or family or neighbors, you know, or someone they know, not knowing what their criminal history might be. Mm-hmm. It's just a lot of people, a lot of the newbies. I mean, every single day someone says to me, I have no experience whatsoever, but hey, guess what? I just joined a group.
Yeah.
And or they'll say to me, do you know any groups that'll take somebody that doesn't have any experience? And this is where I go off on them. Not really, but what's your background? What kind of career do you have? Do you have any experience whatsoever? I mean, it's just, I tell everybody, do not just jump into a group because you want to be a ghost hunter and be cool. And this is the thing to do. That's the problem. It's a problem both ends. You got the people that are eager to be a ghost hunter and get in a group, and you got groups eager to have ghost hunters in it so they can go out and start being the next big group.
Don't you think that everybody thinks that they're going to wind up on TV? Honestly,
yeah.
I really think that people believe that that's going to happen to them. I'm going to be a ghost hunter so I can have a TV show.
I never thought that.
Well, okay, but maybe not you, Chad. So maybe everybody was a little too all-encompassing, but a lot of people believe that.
I have one more question. I used to work for an insurance company where we insured contractors and builders. There's a general liability insurance. What about looking into some sort of liability for people going into other people's homes?
Exactly. And that's one thing that we covered at Ghost Talk, too, with Patrick Burns. It's very expensive to insure yourself or your group.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know the exact charges, but I know it's something I probably can't do myself.
The more people in the group, the more it would cost.
Right. And good luck finding someone to insure you.
Yeah, the limits of liability would cause it to go up as well.
Yep. So it's a tough one, but I think it's a wonderful thing to be insured for everything. I have insurance on my jewelry, my sports collections, my cars, my place. I mean, everything I own is insured, but when we do investigations, for instance, I'm doing Eastern State in 2 weeks, they already have an insurance policy, and that's why they charge insane prices for tickets. So, you know, most of these, like Waverly, most of the bigger places that I've been to recently are all insured. Even Bobby Mackey's has their own insurance. So it's a bar. Well, they have to.
From what I hear of Bobby Mackey's, they need it. They need, like, evil creature insurance or something.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. We just talked to Zach Bagans recently, and he was telling Bobby Mackey stories. My God.
It is pretty raw there, as you've heard me say. It's raw but wonderful.
Yeah, between the two of you, I don't want to go there. Well, actually, I do.
Yeah, you do. I will be there. I'll be there in a couple of weeks, and I couldn't be happier just to be back in that place. It smells, it's dirty, and it's wonderful.
Okay.
Yes. Well, it's wonderfully haunted.
Yeah. Okay, well, since we're talking about Bobby Mackey's, it seems like a good time to segue. One of the things I wanted to talk about was demons and dark energy and what you guys think that is. Now, I know that JD has been doing some research on that. So, JD, you want to go ahead and start on that?
I had done an article, as you know, in the magazine a while back. And Cheryl, Karen, I don't know when that was. It might have been October.
Yes, it was October.
Something like that. But anyway, that's been one of the things I've always been interested in and studied quite a bit and looked at. A few of the things that I found interesting is in religious belief, especially Christian religious belief and even early Jewish religious belief, angels, people, when you talk about angels, you associate them with being, well, not associate, the description of them have always been messengers. Have you guys heard that? that mm-hmm. angels were messengers. I noticed, looking back in history at some historical texts, especially biblical and post-biblical data, when you go back, demons were never really associated with evil in the early days, and I'm talking pre-first century AD. Demons to the Greeks and different Greeks like philosophers, Homer for one and Plutarch for another, had associated them with being messengers. It was a translation from Greek, which meant messenger. Also, early Chaldeans, which predates Sumerian, a lot of the ideologies that we have about angels and demons, messengers or whatever, came from that. The early Jewish beliefs in demons came from that. And when you look at the early Jewish texts, you find that the demon wasn't evil. It was a messenger. Only after the first century, when Christianity comes onto the scene and they start writing the books of the early Bible and they start putting those things in there and together, did the demon become associated with evil? Now, I found that interesting.
Wow.
For one thing, right now, today, we associate that, and culturally that happens. A word become ingrained in a culture, and then the meaning that that culture gives to that word becomes associated with it. And in some cases, it carries on, and this is one of those cases. It makes me wonder where this came from, because afterwards there's an explosion, and especially when you look into the Middle Ages, and you have all of these people, especially around the 1400s, you had all these, like Alphonse de Spina from 1467, who actually classified species of demons. Fates, poltergeists, incubi, and gave descriptions of all of them. And then later, you had a Jesuit who was Peter Vinsfield. He was a Jesuit priest who wrote a big treatise on demons. He wrote that in 1589, and he actually went on one step further and actually named them. And you don't find these names in the Bible, or you don't find them in any of the works, except some you can't. The only one that you can really associate with is from early Chaldean text, which is Beelzebub. And they mm-hmm. called him several different things, and he was actually worshipped. It was a nature god. You look at this, and you wonder how all this was put together and where these things came from, and you really got to go back through those texts and pick out little things, and then you find out when you do that it's bits and pieces of stories that, from cultures that came before him about something totally different. You look at how it actually metamorphosized into what it is today.
Well, didn't the Greeks refer to them as daemons or negative thought forms?
They did, and they were more or less messengers. Plutarch speaks, and I have a quote here. He talks of human souls as commencing first as heroes, then as demons, and then they mutate further and afterward as advancing to a more sublime degree.
My understanding of the negative thought form was that basically it was maybe a negative thought that a human had thought of, and it went out and tried to complete whatever that desire was as a daemon, and it would return once it either completed or it hadn't completed.
Right, right. That was a Greek form of thinking back then. It was called asceticism, and it believed that the entire universe and everything that happened within it was located in concentric rings, with everybody being at the center, the world, and then everything else radiated outward from that in circles. They looked at everything that way, which, and that would fit, you know, with that belief. But you look at the Phoenicians mm-hmm. and the Egyptians. A lot of these people took their custom from them. They accounted them demons as the greatest gods. And like I said, a lot of them were, this was at a time when there was a lot of spirit worship, nature type worship, where everything in nature had a spirit in it. You find early Native American tribes that was part of their beliefs also. Certain powerful gods who caused the sun to come up or go down, you know, were known. But then there were a lot of lesser ones that inhabited other parts of nature, trees, rock,
spirits. What do you think people are encountering today, though? Because I've heard that there's actually a certain feel to a demonic haunting.
I believe that, too. I have to believe there's something out there. But my whole thoughts on the matter are, how did all this come together? And with the names and the things like that we associate today, they pulled from all of this. What's that saying about organized religion? I'm not putting down any religion or anything by any means here, and I'm just talking about history. But during the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church ruled. That was it.
Okay.
And every type of research and every type of science that was just budding at the time, of course, but any thought had to fall in line with thoughts of the church, or you would be dubbed a heretic or blasphemer. You could be executed and killed for that. There were a lot of people who took baby steps and tried to bring their thoughts into line with what the church, and the one about the hierarchy by Despina illustrates that beautifully. You look at it, and he actually, there was a big talk then of the hierarchy of God with the angels and God and Christ and the angels and everybody. Well, they tried to put everything, including everything they observed around them in nature and supernatural, in a hierarchy. And you see that in his description of all the hierarchies in hell. Now, at no time in the Bible do you really see the word hell, and do you see the word Satan? I mean, at one time, I believe in the New Testament, they talk about a place of burning, which was Gehenna, but that was associated with the garbage dump outside of Jerusalem that was constantly burning. And that's what they were associating that with. You don't find out those ideas develop and blow up until the Middle Ages, when a lot of that was happening. And you've seen the hysteria with the witch hunter and things like that. Back then, everything was possessed. I mean, it was like a huge, huge, huge thing. I mean, every time you look, people were nuns, convent, churches, everything was being possessed. And there were a lot of people doing work on this, but a lot of it was philosophy and thoughts, and it just seemed to be incorporated.
Well, you know, I definitely think that there's negative energy out there. What it is, I honestly don't know. You know, Shannon, I know you had an interesting theory about this. I think we touched on it last time in the podcast and in the live chat we had, but I think that whatever it is, there's something definitely there.
Yeah, I can agree with that. Not to change the subject, but it was really interesting. Just last night, I was thinking of you guys because I remembered I'd be talking to you. And I was watching the documentary on Stevie O, and this might pique some of the younger audience's interest. Stevie O is from that show Jackass. Did anyone see that last night?
No.
He's a raging alcoholic, raging drug addict, and everything from nitrous oxide to heroin. And
he likes to staple stuff to his stomach.
He does. Oh, his butt cheeks. He's,
yeah.
He's
great. My kind of guy.
He's well. The reason why he was so nuts and so popular on the show is because he was completely under the influence of something at all times. He literally videotaped his own intervention, and he videotaped a diary of himself every time he did drugs. Just 24/7, he had a camera going. It was shocking. I didn't know this side of him. I've always watched the show, fan of the show, just want to know what kind of goldfish he's going to swallow next. But he said, there was one scene, and I do have a point. There was this one scene where he's curled up in a ball. He had just shot up some heroin, and his voice changed, and he's saying, I want to die, die. And he started speaking a different language, and his eyes were rolling the back of his head. And all I could think of was, he's possessed. And I'm laughing. I'm like, yeah, right. You know, he's a kid on TV who's on, you know, a lot of drugs. He's not possessed. He's just wicked screwed up. A second later, after that thought crossed my head, they panned the camera to his face. He said, back then, I think I was possessed. I was possessed by something. There was a demon. He goes, I was hearing these voices in my head, and they were telling me to kill myself. And these people, he was talking about how he was carrying on full conversations with these voices in his head. Wow. And he actually admitted he thinks he was possessed by a demon. And you know, it's all experiences, because I've seen so much footage of demonic possession. I start to notice the symptoms, the physical symptoms of people, and this is exactly what he was going through. And, of course, everybody associates the voices in your head, kill your parents, kill your brother, kill your sister, the demonic music, depression, suicidal thoughts. I think it's 100% spurred by demonic influence. I mean, you can't, there's so many instances of normal everyday people completely snapping and drowning their children in a car or in a bathtub. This mother, who was a Sunday school teacher last month, killed her child's best friend and cut her up and put her in a suitcase.
Horrible.
What is the raging force behind all of that? Is it mental illness, or did something just completely take over these people? There's so many physical things that show me out there that demonic forces are real.
We had an interview in the October issue. It was called something like Q&A with an exorcist or something like that. And basically, this priest had been conducting exorcisms for a long, long time, like most of his life. He was basically convinced that, yes, you know, there are demons, such things as demons, and they do possess people. And, you know, and he had probably 50 plus years of experience in this area. It really makes me think that there's something there.
Yeah, there could be, definitely.
I've studied this stuff quite a while in my life, probably too much, but my beliefs are, in nature, if there's a positive, there has to be a negative. It's not natural to have one without the other. It's just not, it doesn't happen. You can't. It's impossible. You have to have a negative. Throughout my reading, the one thing that sticks in my mind constantly, and I always think of this, always, and forgive me, I can't recall his name. I quoted him and used his name in the article, but he was a French demonologist from way back when, and he said the one thing to me that has always made me think, and that was that the devil's greatest feat over man was convincing man that he didn't exist. And I think about that. It's possible. And I look at these things, and like Shannon, there's symptoms of possession. You see somebody like that, and a lot of people can associate it with mental illness, and a lot of times it is, but a lot of times it's not. There's other things that you look for when you're investigating these cases, things that really shouldn't be, and I don't want to say given out to the public, but really not. It's dangerous, and there's things that you shouldn't, but there's things to look for. There's certain signs, there's certain ways that you can tell. And Chad, you mentioned earlier, the feeling. All right, there's never been anyone that I have looked at or talked to or read where they have went into a case that hasn't talked about that.
Yeah.
The feeling of oppression, of dread, of despair. And if you would associate anything with hell or something evil, that would be it, those feelings. And it just seemed interesting to me that you can almost track the progression of this history all the way back. Not almost track, you actually can. And at one time, you know, when I had mentioned the Chaldeans, well, the things that they worshipped weren't very nice. I mean, they weren't the, you know, live in the fluffy white clouds with the bright light type God that we worship today, that we associate God being with. They were nasty.
Some
of them were bad.
I would disagree with what you just said. I would say that there are a large number of people who worship something that's not very nice, because in a lot of religious philosophy, God is an angry God. God wants to kill
you. The vengeful God, right.
Absolutely. So
I understand.
I have to disagree with the fluffy white cloud God.
For the most part, that's what people associate that with.
Sure.
For the most part.
Sure.
That's what I mean. And, you know, but their demons, I mean, their gods were pretty bad. I mean, they were, you can call them realistic, I guess. You know, I guess they made a lot of observations in nature, and nature can be cruel. You know, that's what they said. They made sacrifices to these things and on. Then a lot of the words, or a lot of the names, a lot of the association with that and everything came from that area. And when you look at, like, where they started their time and appearance, it was a very primitive demonology of Babylonia, which peopled the world of the Jews with beings of a semi-celestial and semi-infernal nature. When they picked up on that, now remember, the early Jewish people didn't worship a god per se. They came from peasant societies within that area of that time, and they carried a lot of these beliefs with them. It propagated after that. It became part of our religious hierarchy. Now, does that to say they weren't real? No. That's not saying that they're not real at all. It's not saying that they are either, but it's saying that it's interesting that you can go back in history and actually find the origins of the beliefs in them.
Mm-hmm. It's Shannon's scary dog again.
I guess so.
Who jumped?
I did. Oh, Lord. Yes. Let's go ahead and move on from demons, just because we have a few other things that I wanted to talk about. And I promised Cheryl we would talk about this. Cheryl recently interviewed Stan Romanek. And if you don't know who Stan Romanek is, he's the alien in my window guy.
Yes.
The one with the videotape of the alien in his window that's never showed the videotape. And he said he was going to send us stills from the video, and he didn't, did he, Cheryl?
You know, I didn't get anything back on that. The last email communication that I sent off, I didn't hear back from. I didn't follow up either, but no, didn't get anything.
So I'd be curious as to, it sort of ties into the last topic, because I think so many things about paranormal are kind of written off as mental illness a lot. And I'm especially in tune with this right now because I just wrote an article on the psychology of the paranormal. So I just am curious as to everyone's take on Stan Romanek and the alien in his window.
I got to talk to Stan Romanek for a little bit over an hour when I was doing the interview with him for the article. And I believe it was in our February issue of Paranormal Underground. And I actually really enjoyed the conversation that I had with him. He seemed like a very genuine person, that he honestly believed his experience had happened. And what kind of stuck with me is that there were a lot of witnesses in many of the claims or abduction instances in his case. And of course, I didn't talk to those people, so I'm just kind of taking his word at that. But supposedly there are a lot of witnesses, a lot of researchers that have worked on his case, professors and scientific, you know, people, that kind of thing. Karen and I had a long conversation about this and whether, okay, you believe something is real, but it doesn't make it real. And right. I don't know if that makes sense, but just my personal opinion, he definitely came off very genuine. He answered all of my questions.
Mm-hmm. He calls his case the most documented case of alien abduction, right? Isn't that what he
built? Well, I don't know if he built.
Someone calls it that.
Someone builds it that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so are any others of you familiar with the Stan Romanek thing and have any opinions on that?
I read a lot about it after the issue came out. Well, I'm a little skeptical about Stan. I can't poo-poo all of the UFO documentation. You know, over the years, and your issue with Stanton Friedman was really good. But Stan, I don't know, maybe he's the most documented UFO abduction case because he puts himself out there so much.
Could be.
The alien in a window looked to me like a distorted cat.
That was a recreation. He's never released any of that video.
He actually released one still of the video, which was in the article.
I
asked if I could get a look at the video, and he said the video would not be made public until after, I believe, the documentary on his case was released, which I thought should be right around this time. I could be wrong, but that it was going to be eventually made public for everybody to view the complete video. He says that he saw something running away from his window that particular time, and that he had set it up because he was getting frustrated with what he thought was a peeping Tom continually looking into his window. That's kind of how that video came about.
I just have one question. I remember reading about the guy. I remember reading about what happened, but I didn't delve into it even real deep. He's claiming it's the most documented and all that. And okay, that doesn't tell me anything. What has been documented? Does he have proof? Does he have evidence? You know, was there solid evidence out there, or was documented that something was looking in his window and he's got a video of it?
Well, it's not just the video. He has all sorts of other encounters that he talks about. And he has some, what is it, math, Cheryl?
Yeah, yeah, what's happened is that, and I hope I'm describing it correctly, but that he has, let's say, woken up in the middle of the night and started writing these complex math formulas, let's say, on the side wall of his house. And I think he has a fifth grade math equivalency or something to that effect, because he's dyslexic. And he has no clue where he gets these formulas from. They've been analyzed by, you know, mathematicians, and they're just very complex. He says he got them from his encounters, basically. And, you know, I don't think they know exactly what they mean. I think they've tried to interpret them, but yeah.
I'll pitch in one little thing. I was doing a radio show near Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and he was actually the guest on the show. So okay. I was sitting in the seat, and he had called in, and we had pulled up on the video screen the shots, the stills of that form in the window. I had found an inconsistency with his story, and it had something to do, and mind you, this was a year ago, so I don't want to say exactly what it was, because I don't really remember exactly what the inconsistency was, but he couldn't answer it, and it had something to do with the lights he said he left on the inside of the house, yet how would you be able to... With a glare, you would have seen a glare. If lights were left on in the inside of your house, you would have seen a glare on the window and not this perfectly black window with a form on it or something like that. And he said, he kind of pitched in, I really can't answer that, I don't know. So that sort of, to me, you know, he said he was down the hall and he looked out the window, but all the lights were on in the hall, and it didn't make much sense to me, but... You know, the rest of the story was pretty fabulous, I got to say, with the writing on the wall and everything else. So I can't say that one little thing that he left out was a deal breaker for me.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting story, if nothing else.
Right.
Speaking of interesting stories, you guys all know what's been happening with JD. Shannon, I'll fill you in. You obviously know about the Dybbuk box, because I think I emailed you about it, didn't I, Shannon?
You did.
I did. And you
I did my homework.
Yeah, and you kind of said, when I initially sent it to you, you kind of said, I don't know, it could be a story, or, you know, that was sort of your initial response. Well, when we did the podcast, Jason told me several times, you need to be prepared to have technical difficulties. There's going to be something that's happened. I've never not had something happen. Well, during the podcast, of course, if you've listened to it, JD had a tornado warning. Well, the other thing is, JD has been covered in spots for how many weeks now?
Jeez, 4 weeks now, at least?
He has Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
Wait a minute, JD actually has the box?
No, but he was the most critical of the box during our
during
our time with it. And so first I have to ask JD, and he's been trying to tell me the answer to this, and I keep telling him not to. JD, did you mock the box?
I hate that box.
Do you think it has anything to do with it?
No.
You think
I don't.
It's confirmation bias?
Yeah, I really do. I mean, this is tornado season here.
And tick season.
Yeah, and tick season. That's right. We get tornado warnings. We had three yesterday.
Ooh.
All the time. You just take it with a grain of salt and keep an eye out. That's all you can do. It's like hurricanes. That, too, when hurricane season starts. So that didn't surprise me. And I can't say I'd associate that with a box at all.
Okay.
As far as a Rocky Mountain spotted fever goes, if you remember, when we started that podcast, I had already went and they thought it was Lyme disease. Well,
right.
They were waiting for the blood test to come back. And, of course, that Wednesday, I guess, before the podcast, that's when they had called me and said, you need to come in here. And I did, and they're like, nah, the test is back. You've got Rocky Mountain spotted fever. So that was already a done deal. So
but you'd been mocking the box before that, because you and I had been talking. We'd been talking about it for a couple of weeks.
Looking at all that, first of all, with the original story on eBay, and we talked about this, there are a lot of inconsistencies. The lady escaping from the POW camp, okay? That didn't happen. It just did not happen. People didn't escape from concentration camps. There were several instances in history when that happened, okay? And those were so few that the people that escaped were documented. They know who got out.
Right. Yeah,
but,
no, I know.
And then another thing with Jason confirms it, and he's the expert in the antiquities and things. He feels it was put together sometime during the 60s.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, so there's a 20-year lapse, and all right, it reeks of an urban legend. That's what I feel. I feel it's more urban legend related than it is in actuality. Although the research on Dybbuk and everything associated with that was very interesting, but it's possible there could be a entity associated with that. But in my research, and it doesn't mean that it's wrong, because I couldn't find it, but I could not find any instance in Kabbalism or Jewish mysticism or anywhere else where a spirit was associated with the possessing an inanimate object.
Sure. Well, Cheryl,
it was really hard.
Cheryl will not mock the box.
I won't. I refuse to mock it. Yeah. I'm trying to get someone else to mock it and then see if anything happens to them, but I won't mock.
Do we have any takers? Anybody?
You want me to?
Yeah.
I'll mock the box.
No, because I live with you. You can't mock the box.
Okay, so wait. So I have Shannon. Say you would mock the box?
Screw it. I'll do it. The box sucks. The box isn't real.
My God, though.
What have we done?
I Googled Dybbuk box and I could not find any information whatsoever except for it was a movie like 10 years ago or something.
Oh, no, it hasn't been made yet.
Or it hasn't been. I don't know what I'm thinking. I honestly, it's not something. It hasn't. If it only comes back with like one result in Google, I'm not paying much attention to this thing. I don't know if this is just another eBay item on sale gone bad. You can tell I'm a little skeptical about this box, and I'll probably get cancer tomorrow, but...
Oh, God, no.
Well, call us if you do.
You're so sweet. You know, it's...
I am writing this down that Shannon mocked the box at this
point. Okay, 5:50 p.m.
Exactly.
I read the whole thing in detail, and it's so convincing, and it's wonderfully written.
Isn't it a great story?
It's a great story, and it was entertaining. I just can't find anything to back it up. I can't find anything in history about this box. I can't find other boxes like it. I can't find other people complaining about their boxes. Nothing. This thing just appeared out of thin air. I'm going to make up a nice little haunted thing tomorrow. You know those little pink polka-dotted Dalmatians in the windows of Victoria's Secret? I'm going to sell mine... I'm going to sell mine on eBay because it barks at me all the time during radio interviews.
You know, that actually reminds me of this story that somebody was telling me one time of this. Do you remember those Go to Sleep Ernie dolls? Ernie from Sesame Street, and the Ernie would snore and do all sorts of stuff. They swear to God this thing was possessed because they would go into the room and Ernie would be turned off and he would say something like, "I'm sleepy." So they were just absolutely convinced that this thing was possessed. Well, it turned out that it was a known defect of these dolls that it would do this even when it was turned off. But they were just sure that it was... Okay, so the general agreement is, except for Cheryl, who's not mocking, and Chad, who's not allowed, that the box is no threat. You know, there's another haunted object. I can't think of what it's called. It's called the something... It's like the Stokey something chair. And they actually have it hung up on the wall in this museum now. It's in the Thirsk Museum. It's in England. Because when people sit in the chair, supposedly they die.
They die, yeah. I remember reading about that, yeah.
So you'd sit in the chair too, Shannon?
Come on.
Shannon, I think it was, if I remember right, it was associated with one of the places that Ghost Hunters International investigated. It was the chair. No, it was, what's a castle where the Gray Lady is at? Did they look at the Gray Lady?
Honestly, I don't watch the show.
Okay,
but I've heard of the Gray Lady.
That castle she's in, it's supposedly that chair came from there.
It's called the Busby Stoop Chair. I just looked it up. Busby Stoop Chair.
It wasn't Chillingham Castle, was it, J.D.?
I don't remember.
It's in North Yorkshire.
Yeah, somewhere. But
anyway, that was sort of off topic, but I started to think about that. We have it here. Shannon's going to mock the box, and then she's going to go get that chair off the wall.
Whatever.
I got your back, Shannon. I got your back.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on. I think we've put the Dybbuk box to bed. But you know what? I think it's a great story. I do think that Jason believes that there are some things with it. But I think it's a great story.
I do, too. I think it's great.
Absolutely. Okay, well, I want to talk quickly about the movie A Haunting in Connecticut. I went to see it. I thought it was really, really stupid. I'm just looking for everyone else's opinions.
I didn't see the movie, but I can only imagine the artistic license they took with it. I know I'm familiar with the case, but I can't imagine what they did. I'll wait for it to come out on DVD, and then I'll watch it.
Good call. Good call. Anyone else?
Yeah, Chad and I saw the movie. Chad, why don't you take this one?
I thought it was interesting. It was a well-made Hollywood movie, but it was very loosely based on the actual story.
Yeah. Well, wouldn't dead bodies in the walls stink?
Yeah.
Well, he preserved them.
He mummified them, right?
Yeah, he mummified them.
Okay.
Here's the thing. I agree with Chad.
Preservatives.
It's very dramatized quite a bit. I've read up and watched some documentaries, or, you know, I don't know if they're considered documentaries, but some shows on the actual supposed events. And it followed very loosely, but I actually liked the movie. I thought it was entertaining. If you like a moderately scary movie, the acting I thought was pretty darn good. But yeah, it didn't hold to true events as far as what I could tell.
It'd be a great date movie.
Yeah.
I got two words for that one.
Yes.
And you know what's coming, Lorraine Warren.
Oh.
I asked John Zaffis at Ghost Talk, since he was the real person who took care of the real case, I asked him, I said, how different from the movie was the actual events? And he said the movie was an abortion. That was his exact.
Oh.
Yeah.
So that tells you something right there.
That's Hollywood. Well, you know, I compared it to the Amityville Horror. I feel like I got screwed by the Amityville Horror, and darn it, this movie too.
And what's the connection between both of those?
Lorraine Warren, I hear you. All right. Okay, well, next thing I want to talk about is a little bit about brain chemistry, because we're doing our psychology of the paranormal this month, and a lot of the stuff that I came up with in my research for the article on the psychology of the paranormal is that paranormal belief, not necessarily paranormal events, but paranormal belief may be tied into brain chemistry, in particular endorphins, dopamine, serotonin, that type of thing. What it brought up is that there is a school of thought out there that what we are as souls, as human beings, as whatever, is all we are a series of very, very complex chemical reactions. That's what we are, and that's why we do what we do. So I know Cheryl had some opinions on this. So Cheryl?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I am a believer in reincarnation, so, you know. Yeah. I definitely think that we've got more going on than just brain chemistry and then the end. I think that, you know, our energy carries on after physical death. And I mean, there's certain things that I just don't think that can be explained away by brain chemistry, you know, certain paranormal things and ESP, telekinesis, you know, predictions of the future. There's so many things that happen that I don't think that we can just explain with that definition.
Sure.
Well, I know the Jonathan Keel, who was involved with the Mothman, and he believes that basically the paranormal and stuff we see is our brain's reaction to an energy form that these supposed extra-dimensional beings put off. So that's why we see UFOs, the Mothman, stuff like that, and ghosts.
So he's saying that it's reacting to the energy of something and creating something that we recognize?
Yeah, or something that we can correlate to represent that. Because I know even in alien abduction cases, when you initially remember it, you might remember like an owl or some kind of animal, but then like if you went through a hypnoregression or something like that, you would actually remember what actually happened.
I see. Okay, interesting. Teresa, Shannon, either of you have anything on this one?
Nope.
The body, the chemical responses that you're talking about are electrical impulses that fire through the body. The one thing that I have on that is the only thing that I remember at all from physics is that energy can neither be created nor destroyed.
Yes.
When the physical body dies, what happens to the energy? Where does it go?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
That's my biggest question. I don't have an answer for it.
Yeah. Yep. Well, you know, I used to work for a chiropractor, and chiropractor considers itself energy medicine. And the chiropractor that I worked for did a technique called Toftness. And what it is he had this little disc that he would wear on his belt, and he would rub his fingers on the disc and run his other hand up the back. And when he would get to a place where the energy was blocked by the spine being misaligned, so it would block the nerve energy, that damn thing would squeak. And seriously, and inevitably, it was in the right place where there was this impingement on the nerve, and the nerve energy wasn't flowing very strongly. So I asked him, I said, have you ever used this on a cadaver? Because, of course, I always have all these questions like this. I said, have you used this on a dead body? And he said, yeah. Yeah, I have. And I said, and? He said, it doesn't squeak. It doesn't do anything. So, who knows? Hmm. Yeah, I know. Makes you wonder, doesn't it?
If I see it on 2020, I'll believe it.
Well, you know how they say ghosts and stuff are maybe related to electromagnetic energy? I would think that would have an effect on our body.
Yeah?
Something I came across earlier I found interesting. We're talking about chemistry and all that. Early paranormal investigators, and I'm talking about the late 1800s. This was from around 1896. There was a man who was a prolific writer, and he wrote a lot about investigating, and his stuff that you look at now is a wealth of old folklore and things like that that you can actually go to and read and glean a lot of information from. But his name was Elliot O'Donnell, and he had recorded some things about, at the time, people who were interested in paranormal associated the appearance of a spirit or entity with the color that a candle burned. Is anyone familiar with that?
Mm-mm. Only what you told me today, yeah.
Yeah, he felt that the big, and I don't want to call it a myth, but the thing then was, if a candle burned blue, now this was before we had electricity and things like that, so, you know, you can't really associate electromagnetism with it. If a candle burned blue, there was a paranormal entity in the room. I know in chemistry, one of the experiments for different types of chemical properties, you change the color of the flame, correct?
Yeah, I remember.
And you use different chemicals to change it. Well, he goes on in this article, he talks about what types of spirits were near based on what color the candle was burning. Huh. And he felt that blue represented a higher order of a spirit, and once again the hierarchy thing comes to play here. Different colors, other colors represented lower orders of spirit. He also says that in his study, he claimed to be not clairvoyant or psychic, but he claimed to have a lot of paranormal encounters of his own, seeing apparitions and things, that when he was in his study, sometimes at night he'd be writing by the candle, and he would notice a blue glow on the pages he was writing, and he would look at the candle and it was burning blue, and he knew there were spirits nearby. A lot of people of that period would use candles to detect ghosts, like they use EMF meters today. So
I have one last topic, and I'm sorry this wasn't on your list, but I think you'll bear with me on this. In the past week, the paranormal world has lost just an absolute giant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I just kind of wanted to get everybody's thoughts on Hans Holzer. So let's,
sad.
Yeah, let's start with Shannon, because I know he was an idol of yours.
Yeah, I was just a kid, you know, a young kid reading his big fat books, and the books were boring now that I think about it, but they were so informative, and I couldn't put them down. It was just his detail of every little investigation and everyone he had spoken to was just fascinating now that I think about it. And, you know, he lived to a ripe old age, thank God, and the number one pioneer in the field, right up there with Ed Warren, and you know, nobody will ever, ever, ever forget that. Nobody comes close to the experiences that he had and his knowledge in the field. He might not have had all this gizmo equipment, you know, that we have today, but he didn't need it, which kills me, you know. So it's a very sad day. My heart broke when I heard about that. But you knew it was going to come sooner or later, and, you know, definitely the number one person in my mind when I think of pioneer.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was an inspiration for many. I mean, I know he wrote over 100 books on supernatural and the occult. And I just know that he influenced and affected a lot of people.
Yeah.
He will be missed.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Shannon says, he was a true pioneer in the modern paranormal age.
He was, absolutely. Yeah.
Like Shannon, when I was a kid, I could not get my hands on his books fast enough. I read him and read him and read him. And the thing I liked about him the most, like Shannon said, his books were really big, but, you know, and kind of boring. But he tended to present the information as it was, information. And as you read and turned the pages, he didn't evoke a lot of his opinion on the subject into what he was writing about, but more or less left the reader open to form their own opinions. And he even left you, and I've done this a lot reading his books, I wanted more when it was over, and I would actually, you know, go and try to research these things and find out more about these subjects and stuff, which led you to other books that weren't so good and all. But every time one hit the shelf, I had it. And he's going to be missed. He's an excellent, excellent author.
Right. Well, I have two thoughts. One is that I picked up his book, one of his books that I have. It was something about the ghost hunter tells ghost stories or something. The very first story in there, he's talking about a comely young woman who is a champagne glass stripper. And just, it was so charmingly told. It was really entertaining. And I enjoyed, the guy can spin a yarn. And so I enjoyed that about him. And the other thing is something that a story that one of our forum members told, because we had a thread about his death. And she said that her mother saw him somewhere. And she went up to him and she said, "Oh, I just enjoy your book so much." And he said, "You're one of the few who do." So
sounds like a very humble person.
Well, right. He sounds like somebody who probably tilted at windmills for a lot of his life, because he was a pioneer in the field, and the paranormal field has come a long way. So all right, we're pretty much up on time, and I know that Chad and Cheryl have to go to a Little League game. I appreciate everybody taking the time to do the roundtable. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Good time.
You're welcome.
All right,
you're welcome.
Thanks, guys.
If you'd like to be a panelist on Paranormal Underground Presents or have a guest or topic suggestion, please email editor@paranormalunderground.net. Thank you for joining us.
Evidence, you know, was there solid evidence out there, or it was documented that something was looking in his window and he's got a video of it?
Well, it's not just the video. He has all sorts of other encounters that he talks about. And
a glare, if lights were left on in the inside of your house, you would have seen a glare on the window and not this perfectly black window with a form on it or something like that. And he said, he kind of pitched in, I really can't answer that. I don't know.
It just did not happen. People didn't escape from concentration camp. There were several instances in history when that happened, okay? And those were so few.
Snore and do all sorts of stuff. Well, they swear to God this thing was possessed, because they would go into the room and Ernie would be turned off and he would say something like, "I'm sleepy."
He preserved them.
He mummified them, right?
Yeah, he mummified them.
Okay. Well,
here's the thing. I agree with Chad.
Preservatives.
It's very dramatized quite a bit.
My hands on his books fast enough. I read him and read him and read him. And the thing I liked about him the most, like Shannon said, his books were really big, but prolific writer. And he wrote a lot about investigating, and his stuff that you look at now is a wealth of old folklore and things like that that you can actually go to.
You know, definitely the number one person in my mind when I think of pioneer.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was an inspiration for many. I mean, I know he wrote over...
So I enjoyed that about him. And the other thing is something that a story that one of our forum members told, because we had a thread about his death. And she said that her mother saw him somewhere and she went up to him and